You're listening to the Vegans Explore Network, found at vegansexplore.com.
A lot of you know our guest and have followed his presentations, his books, even his organization that we'll get into in a moment. So everyone, give a warm round of applause to Dr. Neil Barnard. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you.
What I want to do with this conversation is a little bit different than I do with most, is I want to take a lot of the questions, the common questions that I know you hear, that I hear through the podcast and through the panels and the festivals, and just compile them so that way anyone watching this now or watching it in the future can have these little nuggets that they can take away and have quick answers from a plant-based physician. So that's going to be the format for this podcast. So before we do that, I happen to have next to me a couple of books that I feel would be extremely helpful for people to check out. And one of them that I don't have is your latest book, and that is Your Body in Balance. So before I go into the other show and tell books that I have next to me, do you want to tell us a little bit about Your Body in Balance?
Sure. Your Body in Balance, it was really a turning point for me. I've written about 20 books before that. And what we discovered is that we could control hormones with our foods. What I mean is estrogen, female sex hormones. These are the drivers of breast cancer, as we've been talking about. You can change the level of estrogen in your body. Who could imagine it? By changing what you eat. You can also change how testosterone acts in your body. You can change insulin. These are all hormones that are made in the body, and they control various functions in your body. So up until then, we all thought, well, I eat a bad food, I get high cholesterol. I eat a bad food, my blood pressure goes up. We can be much more sophisticated. By using certain foods to dial our hormones up or down, we can control parts of our health that we never imagined we could control before.
Wow. And it's interesting. I'm looking at all these books right now. What I'm going to do, the format I'm going to share with you is just showing you the book and you just tell me a little bit about it. And you can go as long as short as you want. So we have Power Foods for the Brain.
Yeah, thank you. If you make a list of all the diseases you never want to get, at the top of that list is Alzheimer's disease. But we found that certain food choices can influence Alzheimer's disease risk. I'll give you an example. People who eat the least bad fat, saturated fat, animal fat, people who avoid that, they cut their risk of Alzheimer's by about 2/3. That's just the beginning. There's a lot more we can do, but Power Foods for the Brain is a guide to keeping your brain working all throughout life.
Nice. The next one that I have is 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart.
Many people want to lose weight. They want to get healthier or whatever their reason may be, but they often do it in ways that are really tough on them and tough on just everybody who tries these. They try counting calories. They try cutting carbohydrate. They go ketogenic or something like that. What the 21-Day Weight Loss Kickstart is, it's a way in a short period of time to jump into the deep end of a really healthy diet, a completely plant-based diet, but you do it step by step so that you take advantage of what healthy foods will do for you. You don't have to limit portions. You don't have to avoid carbohydrates. You're eating healthy foods. And if weight loss is your goal, this is the book that gets you there.
All right. And then I'm sure you have more, but this is the last one that I have next to me. We have The Cheese Trap.
When we do research studies, people change their diets. They do great. But the one food that keeps kind of in the back of their mind is cheese. People say, you know, I think I'm kind of addicted to cheese. And the answer is, yes, you may well be. We found that there are certain compounds in cheese that truly are addictive. We explained to you what they are, how you can break that cheese addiction and maybe regain your health. We also go into other things, what cheese does to your body in many ways, what the animals go through on a dairy farm, and a lot of replacements for cheese with all the flavor, none of the regrets.
Nice. So now what we're going to do now is just go through some of the questions that we've compiled, and we may go over some territory that you just addressed, but we'll probably go a little bit of a deeper dive into them. So the first question I want to talk about is a topic that I've seen pop up a lot in maybe the last 4 years, and that's diabetes. Now, is it possible to reverse type 2 diabetes by adopting a plant-based lifestyle? And if so, what would that look like?
Yes. Back in 2003, the National Institutes of Health funded us to test a new way of thinking about diabetes. The traditional approach was to reduce carbohydrates and sugar in your diet and to limit calories. And that's logical. But we decided to do something different. And that was a diet with no animal products and keeping oils really low. And we found that this new approach was 3 times better at reducing blood sugar compared to the other. And it also was started to open the door to people having diabetes improve to the point where they needed less medicine, maybe no medicine at all, or maybe the disease itself actually went away. The discovery here that we're hinging on was the discovery that sugar doesn't cause diabetes. It's caused by fatty foods, putting fat particles inside your muscle and liver cells that cause your insulin to not be able to work in those cells anymore. The cells get gummed up. Well, we get that gummy fat out of your cells by changing your diet, and diabetes improves dramatically.
Now, is it still a competition between those two ideologies that it's sugar or animals, or has it shifted more towards one versus the other?
Some people still imagine that sugar may cause diabetes, but they're wrong. Scientists have moved long beyond that, long past that. The world is not flat, and sugar does not cause diabetes. You can imagine a person thinking it does because if I eat sugar, my blood sugar goes up, but that's not the cause of diabetes. Type 2 diabetes starts as insulin resistance, which is caused by the buildup of fat inside the muscle and liver cells. And if we tackle that, we can tackle the disease.
Nice. And shifting to another health condition that a lot of people, especially people, in the African American Black community, deal with, people, even people within my family, high blood pressure. So how, what is high blood pressure's relationship to eating animal products? Is there a correlation between the two?
Now some people can get high blood pressure even if they're following a pretty healthy diet, but there are drivers of it that we can control. And the first one, I guess everybody knows about, salt increases your blood pressure. And so if a person limits the amount of salt that they're eating, especially the salt that's used in preparation or that's used in the commercial products that you might buy, that's actually a bigger driver than the little bit of salt you might add at the table. So when people reduce their salt intake, their blood pressure will go down somewhat. However, researchers have found that when you shift to a plant-based diet, it has a much bigger effect in a variety of ways. First of all, plants don't have much sodium. They've got potassium, which lowers blood pressure. Secondly, they don't have a lot of fat. And when you get the fat out of your diet, your blood changes. It becomes more watery. It flows more easily. It's less like oil. And when your blood is less viscous, your blood pressure comes down. The third thing that happens is over time, when a person follows this healthy diet, they lose weight, and weight loss lowers your blood pressure too. So it's no surprise that vegans have been shown to have really low blood pressure, and it's a great way to go to reduce your blood pressure. That said, if you're on blood pressure medicines, do not throw them away. Work with your doctor to taper off your medicines if and when the time is right.
And then there's also a lot of confusion between being vegan and eating a whole food plant-based diet. Any precautions for people who may be transitioning into that lifestyle, thinking, okay, well, I'm just going to, eat a lot of bread and Oreos and such, and I'm going to, check all these boxes for my health?
Well, a vegan diet is always a good thing. It is true there are a lot of foods that are vegan that may not be the healthiest for us, but going vegan just means a person who decides I'm going to be vegan. What that means is I'm not eating animals anymore. That's a really good step, almost no matter how you do it. So getting the meat and the cheese and the junk out of your diet is a good thing. But you're not done. There are more choices that you're going to want to make too. You want to have foods that are kind of low in fat, don't have a lot of grease built in. There are a lot of food manufacturers who are keen to dump coconut oil into foods, they're doing it to try to simulate that buttery flavor that animal products may have. You don't want that. You want foods that are simpler and healthier for you. But getting away from animals, always a great idea. And with what's left, you want the healthiest choices. And there's one supplement that you really ought to take. That's vitamin B12. You need it for healthy nerves, healthy blood, and it's in every multiple vitamin you ever took. But don't neglect it.
So this next question is a little bit of a weighted question because it can go in so many different directions, but maybe just focusing on some of the higher level in your face things that might be out there. And everyone's like, what is the question? The question is, what role do animal-based foods play in developing different types of cancer?
They play a variety of roles. Where we see the biggest effects of diet on cancer risk are diets that relate to our digestive tract, so colorectal cancer, for example, but also hormone-related cancers like breast cancer, prostate cancer, and other forms that are related to hormones. In both cases, diet plays a big role. For your digestive tract, that's no surprise. If you're eating plants, plants have fiber. Fiber cleans out your digestive tract. Animal products do not have fiber. It's not in Spam. It's not in fried chicken. It's not in organic wild-caught salmon. It doesn't have fiber. It doesn't have what you need. Plants do. But it's more than that. When people eat animal products, the fiber-depleted foods that also tend to be fairly fatty cause the amount of certain hormones to rise to an unhealthy level. Estradiol in particular, that's a female sex hormone. It rises in women who are on a meaty diet, and the estradiol attaches to the alpha receptor on the breast cell and increases the risk of breast cancer. So we encourage women to avoid animal products to reduce their cancer risk.
And you mentioned something earlier in the podcast in terms of how you eat when you're younger can play a role in your life and later in your life. How does that connect to all of this? So like, let's say I'm a teenager, I'm having a good time. And then you decide to shift later in your 20s. Is it possible to negate that those behaviors from the past, or do you still have to kind of take that into account?
Well, now is always the best time to change. If you haven't made a change, now is the time to do it. You can't redo your childhood. But what got us thinking in this direction was soy products. Soy products reduce cancer risk. And let me say that again. Soy products reduce cancer risk. The reason I want to emphasize that is some people got the opposite idea. They went online and they heard that soy products somehow causes breast cancer or whatever. It's the opposite, because soy products have isoflavones that reduce cancer risk. So researchers started to identify who got the biggest benefit. And it was women consuming a lot of soy, especially early in life. So let's say I got two families. One family raises their kids with cow's milk. Cow's milk turned into ice cream. Cow's milk turned into cheese. Another family says, let's develop a taste for soy milk. Let's try soy yogurt, soy milk, soy ice creams. If you compare those two groups, the ones where soy has been a big part of their life, growing up as women, you have about a 30% reduction in your likelihood of developing breast cancer. So It's something you want to take advantage of.
And that was going to actually be my next question in regards to soy, because even within the vegan plant-based movement, there's a lot of people that will completely avoid soy, and you touched on that. And why do you feel like this has happened, and what are they specifically referring to? Because I've heard a bunch of things regarding estrogen levels in men and development of fatty tissue, breast tissue, and things regarding GMO versus non-GMO. So can we just dig a little bit deeper into that soy conversation?
Okay. All right. First of all, genetically modified organisms. You can have a soy plant that's genetically modified. That's not what you would be eating. GMO soy is used as cattle feed and chicken feed. And so people who are eating chicken wings or eating pork chops or whatever are eating animals that were fed GMO all their life. If you buy a block of tofu or a carton of milk, look for the word organic. The federal government, when you label something organic, the federal government will not allow it to be GMO. So GMO is not going to be in your life. I wouldn't worry about that with soy at all. The other part of the soy controversy really is this idea of phytoestrogens. The other word is isoflavones. And they were discovered decades ago. And researchers found that they do attach to estrogen receptors. And that started this myth that they would have to cause cancer, because if they attach to these receptors on the cells, it must be they'll cause cancer. Well, the studies didn't turn out to show that. They showed that women eating more soy had much less cancer. And we finally figured out why. There are two different estrogen receptors. Estrogen receptor alpha, which when something attaches to that, you have a higher cancer risk. That's like the gas pedal for cancer. Estrogen receptor beta is different. It's the brake. And that's where the soy isoflavones attach. So you want to bring the soy in your life. It's not required. You don't have to have it. But women who consume it have less risk of breast cancer. Men who consume soy have less risk of prostate cancer. And plus, it's delicious. You don't have to apologize to the earth for destroying it, which is what the dairy industry is busily doing by having cows belching methane day and night. With soy, you don't have to apologize for any of that stuff.
And you set up the perfect segue to the next question. Does milk do a body good?
I don't think it does any body good. It doesn't do your body good, but I got to tell you, it doesn't do the cow's body any good. There are some people, many people, who will go vegetarian because they want to be kind to animals. And that's a great thing. But they've missed a fact that I'm going to tell you, which is where your glass of milk comes from. Cows don't make milk until they've been impregnated and given birth. That's how the system works. And they're impregnated in a not very nice way on the farm. And when they give birth, their calves are taken away. Because obviously, if the calves drink the milk, there's nothing left to sell. So the male calves are all killed for veal. The females are all taken away from their mothers and put in isolation housing until they can be artificially inseminated. By about age 4, the dairy farmers discover that they're not producing as much milk as they did when they were 2 or 3. And although a cow will live to be 20 in nature, on a dairy farm, they live to be about 4. At which point they're hung up by their leg and they're killed just like any meat, beef cattle. So the dairy industry is a meat industry. Every dairy cow turned into low-grade hamburger. It's just they were artificially inseminated, separated from their offspring over and over again until they were killed. It's a creepy thing for people who have seen it. And for a lot of people, they consider it even more inhumane than the meat industry. I'm not setting up a competition, but what I am saying is there are really good choices for you and for them.
So basically, not only are they being slaughtered, but they're being tortured as well.
Anybody who lives near a dairy farm, you'll hear the cries of the mother cows. And you'll also hear the cries of the calves. There's no bond in nature stronger than the mother-infant bond. And that little calf, when she's born, they come by in a wheelbarrow and they push the mother out of the way. They pick up the calf, stick her in the wheelbarrow, and they carry her out, and the mother follows because that's her baby. Mm-hmm. And then a gate slams in her face and she stands there and she cries. And there are hundreds and hundreds of these animals, of course, on the farms, and in some cases thousands. And people who live nearby hear the cries of the mothers and they think, isn't that kind of heartbreaking? But they, I love my ice cream, or I love my Velveeta, or whatever the case is. But really, the environmentalists are the ones who are the harshest critics of the dairy industry. Because we have, 80 or 100 million cows in the U.S. If you put them all on a balance, one side of a balance, put all the humans on the other side of the balance, the cows outweigh us. Mm-hmm. Each one is as big as a sofa. And they are ruminant animals, which means they belch methane. And methane is a much more potent greenhouse chemical than CO2. So yes, it's good to think environmentally in all aspects of our lives, but job one is change what you have for breakfast.
And every once in a while I'll see an article, they'll talk about a dairy farm closing and things like that, but has there been an actual shift in the consumption of dairy milk versus these alternative milks? Is it moving in the right direction from what you've seen?
Oh, yes, dramatically. I mean, the dairy case used to be a dairy case. You would open the door and there was milk in there. Now you go to the dairy case and what do you see? Almond milk, oat milk, rice milk, hemp milk, soy milk, all these things. And the dairy industry is not stupid. I mean, these big companies are investing in that too. They're thinking, I want to hedge my bets and I want to make sure that I'm not left out. Now, the dairy farms are closing for a couple of reasons. One is lack of demand. The other is that they're consolidating. So now it's not the ma and pa operation somewhere milking their cow. It's huge, huge operation. In the same way as the chicken industry isn't a couple of chickens running around in the pasture. You know, all of these things are effectively factories now.
You brought it up, so let's go there. Chickens and eggs, which came first? No. Is there any nutritional benefit to eating eggs? Because this is what I hear all the time, and as a counterpoint to eggs are unhealthy, there's always someone who has a list of things why eggs are healthy. So from your mouth, what is your truth around eggs?
Well, keep in mind, when a chicken lays an egg, in that egg is everything it takes to make a chick. While that egg is incubating, you know, the little chick inside there who's growing isn't ordering out for takeout food. Everything that it takes to make a beak and eyes and a liver and feet is inside that egg. So it's got a ton of cholesterol. You need cholesterol to make a chicken. You need animals use cholesterol to make their various organs. It's got a ton of animal fat, and it's got some protein and so forth as well. And so out pops a little chicken, and you've got all these preformed things. So the point I'm making is there's a lot of stuff in there that you don't want in your body, because it's the things that the chicken's body needs, but that you don't. Chicken eggs are among the very highest sources of cholesterol. And when you, some people imagine that the cholesterol they eat is somehow going to just bounce off and not affect their arteries. But about roughly half the cholesterol in the foods you eat goes into your bloodstream. And when it goes in, it increases your risk of heart problems. So I would take that egg and just set it aside. I would leave it alone. You don't need that.
And since we're on the topic of cholesterol, by adopting a plant-based lifestyle, are we ridding ourselves of all of the harmful cholesterol, or is it still possible, depending on the types of foods you eat, to still be at risk for high cholesterol levels?
Well, there's no cholesterol in a plant product. Or virtually none. The cholesterol is in animal products. And when you stop eating animal products, you stop eating cholesterol. Great. However, when you eat animal fat, saturated fat, that stimulates your body to make more cholesterol. Now, most plant fats are really low in saturated fat, so they're much, much better. But a couple of exceptions, coconut oil and palm oil, also palm kernel oil. These are high in saturated fat and they stimulate cholesterol formation. The sad thing is that some culinary folks, food manufacturers, love coconut oil because it has that buttery mouthfeel. Mm-hmm. So they'll take your innocent commercial product, cookies or whatever, and they'll stick coconut oil in it or palm oil. Look at a jar of peanut butter. It's not just ground up peanuts, which is what it should be. They added palm oil to it. Look for the brands that don't have palm oil and coconut oil. And if you avoid those things, your cholesterol level is likely to fall further.
When I was made aware of palm oil, I then suddenly realized how many of those off-the-shelf snacks have palm oil in it. So it's just like, once you're aware of it, you're able to navigate and find those healthy alternatives. And of course, the healthiest alternative are those whole fruits that you can just pick up and wash and eat.
That's exactly right. And if it's a commercial product that's got a food label, look at the food label. Look at saturated fat. It'll say sat fat. You want that to be zero or pretty close to zero.
Nice. So one of the big things that happens all the time that gets the community, when I say community, the vegan community, in an uproar, are when celebrities decide to stop being vegan because of XYZ reasons. And one of the reasons that I hear come up a lot, even if it's just for a temporary amount of time, is pregnancy. So if someone's listening to this right now and they've adopted that lifestyle and they're hearing these things, what would you say to them in regards to being on a plant-based lifestyle and going through a pregnancy?
Well, first of all, I think we can kind of forgive these celebrities or other people, because keep in mind, they didn't grow up in a vegan culture. It's new to them. And so their family members are worried about them. And if you're a pregnant woman, you get unsolicited advice from your parents, from other people, from somebody you're sitting next to on a bus. You know, people want to tell you what to do. And so you're nervous and you think, gee, if I'm missing something, you know, I want to add it. So they make mistakes. They think, well, I should have a little dairy or a little chicken or some fish or whatever, and they put that back into their diet. So that's not a healthy choice, but you can understand why people, why that happens. And it wouldn't happen if people had, as vegan diets take hold and people are more used to it and they understand how to navigate it better, they're less likely to make these indiscretions. But a plant-based diet is the best diet from conception onward. Mm. So when a woman is pregnant, if she's on a meaty diet, her risk of birth complications is higher. Her risk of preeclampsia, that hypertension that you see during pregnancy, is much higher. The risk is higher. The risk of gestational diabetes is higher. And the risk of nutrient deficiencies is higher. Now, that sounds funny, doesn't it? But that's because the B vitamins, like folic acid, they are in plants. That's where they are. Keep in mind, you're not a cat. You're not going to have a litter of kittens. So it's not like mama needs to eat meat for your little babies. We are, whether we like it or not, in the family of great apes. Chimpanzees, bonobos, orangutans, gorillas, those are our cousins. And so these are the plant eaters of the world. And we, our bodies are designed to extract nutrients from vegetables and fruits, as well as from beans and whole grains. And if our diet is built from those foods in the cleanest possible forms, and do take your prenatal vitamins, you go to see your obstetrician, they say, here's some prenatal vitamins for you, take them. They've got the B12 that you need, and they're going to look after you, and you are going to be the healthiest mom, and your kid is lucky to have you as a parent.
And still on this train, there are a few things that I've heard come up, and I just wanted to see if you can address them. Certain ailments that make it not impossible, but a little bit more difficult to adopt a plant-based lifestyle. One thing that comes to mind is Hashimoto's. Like, are there things like that that would make it complicated? And if so, what are some tips that you can give them to help them stay the course?
Well, Hashimoto's thyroiditis is hypothyroidism. Your thyroid gland, which is at the base of your neck, and it makes thyroid hormone, which gives you energy. In Hashimoto's thyroiditis, for whatever reason, your thyroid gland isn't putting out as much thyroid hormone as it should. Why? Blood tests show, and your doctor does this in the process of diagnosing it, that you've got antibodies that are attacking your thyroid gland. Where do they come from? Well, one of the theories with any autoimmune condition is that the foods that you eat have proteins in them that elicit your body to react to those seemingly foreign proteins by making antibodies to knock them out. And in Hashimoto's thyroiditis, researchers in the Adventist Health Study brought in a large group of people, and they found that the people with the highest risk of getting Hashimoto's thyroiditis were people who ate a lot of dairy. Hmm. Now, the theory, it hasn't really been put to a good test, I don't think yet, but the theory is that it's the proteins in dairy, because many people react to the proteins in dairy, and dairy proteins are linked to pretty much all the major autoimmune conditions, not just Hashimoto's. And when it comes to hyperthyroidism, Graves' disease, where your thyroid shutoff mechanism is not working right, dairy eaters and meat eaters both have a particularly high risk compared to vegan. So your thyroid loves it if you go on a plant-based diet. But nobody has yet done a study where you take a large group of people who are hypothyroid, who have Hashimoto's, and put them on a vegan diet to see how many of them get better. We have lots of anecdotal cases of people who have done that. If you have Hashimoto's, I would strongly encourage you to do a completely plant-based diet. That may or may not help the Hashimoto's. We just have to see. And don't fire your endocrinologist. By all means, you should still get whatever medical treatments you may need. But a plant-based diet would be the treatment of choice.
So now this is more of like a health thing. And there are different ways of controlling your health and your weight. And one of the popular things are intermittent fasting, eating one meal a day. What are your thoughts on that? Should we be eating multiple meals a day? Is it okay just to eat one? Is breakfast a myth? Like, what are your thoughts on? I threw a lot at you right there, but what are you?
Well, you're talking about meal timing. You know, the science has shifted over time. Years ago, it was three meals a day, and then people started to favor grazing, where you'd have multiple small meals. And that didn't really work out so hot. So people are now exploring different approaches where you take some time off from eating. Sometimes people will do intermittent fasting, where for say 2 days a week, you eat less. You can do that. But then sometimes people end up anticipating those 2 days off by overeating on Friday or overdoing it on Monday when they come back or something like that. On our research team, Dr. Hanna Kaliova has been a big advocate for two meals a day. And so you'll have a pretty big breakfast, which does seem to help people. I have to say, people who have a big breakfast, they're healthier, they have a healthier body weight, and they're healthier in many ways compared to people who skip breakfast. And then her second big meal will be maybe a big lunch around 1 o'clock or something like that. And she doesn't have a big meal for the rest of the day. But you can put that to work or not, see what works for you. The key is, if you're eating really healthful foods, then your normal appetite control is able to work with you to figure out your own mealtime.
And then this will be, we're winding down now as we get to the end of the podcast. And the last question I want to ask is regarding fiber. I know we talked about it a little bit at the top of the podcast. How important is fiber to you, to your body? And why should people, you know, make sure that they're having an adequate or a good amount of it in their system?
Well, fiber is essential. It's plant roughage. It's the part of the plant that doesn't get digested and kind of moves through you. And if you want to ever prove to yourself how important fiber is, just go on a completely Atkins diet for a little while. This is that fad diet from the 1950s where people didn't eat fiber and they would eat meat and gravy and things, thinking that if they avoided carbs, they would lose weight. Well, for some of these people, the constipation became heroic, where their digestive tract just shuts down and it's like you've got a brick inside you. Anyway, don't do that. Your body needs fiber, not just for digestive regularity, but that fiber is doing things. As the fiber goes down your digestive tract, it takes some of those unabsorbed calories and carries them out. So it helps you to lose weight. When the fiber arrives in your large intestine, it actually fosters the growth of a healthy microbiome. Those are the good bacteria that love you back. And meat eaters have plenty of unhealthy bacteria that will, over the long run, increase their risk of cancer of the colon and other problems. So fiber is really important. Fiber also helps your body to get rid of other things like excess estrogens. So a high fiber diet is part of our approach to preventing breast cancer and other forms of the disease as well. So fiber is big stuff.
And the last thing I'm going to have you do, and we have a tradition here on the podcast where we turn the episode, the podcast, over to our guests to give a moment from the heart to our listeners or to our viewers. And it's whatever message you want to relay to our audience. And then whenever you feel complete, that will be the end of the podcast. So before I kick it off to you, I just want to thank you so much for being on the show, for sharing your years of knowledge with our audience, and for partnering with us for the event that we have coming up on October 29th at 12 o'clock at History Fort Lauderdale Museum, SoFlo Vegans Unite, and the Let's Beat Breast Cancer Rally with the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. So thank you so much for all your support.
Well, thank you. I might just say a quick word. When I was a kid growing up in Fargo, North Dakota, my father was the diabetes expert for Fargo and all of Eastern North Dakota. He'd come home and he'd arrive home at about 6 o'clock and set down his medical bag. And I never heard him say that anyone with diabetes ever got better. Their job was really just to try to slow down the progression of the disease. Well, when we started to add something to this in my own medical career, we started to use foods in a more healthful way. We discovered that we could tackle that disease like never before. But that power extends beyond diabetes to heart disease, to certain forms of cancer, to many other conditions. And we discover that foods are a powerful medicine. Yes, it's the best tasting medicine you could ever imagine, but it's really great for your body. And beyond that, I found myself discovering other things, that this is a diet that is really good to protect the planet and also to protect all the animals that we share it with. That's all a good thing. But maybe the most important thing that I think a lot of people can think about is a healthy diet is the best gift that you can give to the next generation. Let's face it, Kids face a lot of challenges these days of all kinds. You know what I'm talking about. And when they grow up with healthy food habits, and it just becomes part of what they do, they're at much less risk for all the challenges that they would otherwise face. They may not thank you, but you're the one who gets the credit. So I thank you for that. I also want to say a huge thanks to my friends at SoFlo Vegans. You've been doing such wonderful work. It's been an honor for me to be able to partner with you. Thank you for all that you do to get the word out.